discussion of the end of the world, the edge of the world. It's in Spain. I grew up thinking it was in East Texas, but really it's in Spain, or at least it was in Spain. Back then it was called the Pillars of Hercules. Have you heard this story, the story of Hercules? You know, he was this fabled hero of ancient Greek mythology, and he was given 12 great labors to complete. And one of those was that he had to go to the furthest point west and to collect a huge herd of cattle and bring them back to the king of Greece. And so that was in Spain. And so he went as far west as he could go to go get those cattle. Now, in order to get where he wanted to go, he had to cross a mountain. It was the Mount Atlas. Actually, it used to be, if you read Greek mythology, you know it used to be Atlas, and then it became a mountain. So anyway, it was this huge mountain, and this is Hercules, so he doesn't go across mountains. He splits them in two. So he uses his superhuman strength. He splits the mountain in two, and inadvertently, in the process, connects the Mediterranean Sea and the Atlantic Ocean. So now there's two mountains, one on either side of this water passageway, and those two mountains were called the Pillars of Hercules. You can actually see them in the Spanish flag and the Spanish crest. You see these two pillars, and there's a ribbon going between them. It actually eventually becomes the dollar sign in the U.S., the two pillars and the line in between them. So anyway, just for your information. But we call those now the Strait of Gibraltar. Strait of Gibraltar. And the Atlantic Ocean wasn't traveled much. I mean, people back in those days traveled just along the coastways. They didn't go very far out into the water because Plato said that the lost city of Atlantis was out there. All the maps showed monsters out there, sea monsters that were waiting for you. And, of course, the world was flat. And so if you sailed too far, you'd go off the edge of the planet. And nobody wants that to happen. And so if you were a sailor and you were traveling through the Strait of Gibraltar, headed from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic, what you would see were large hand-painted signs along the way warning you. And the signs would say, non plus ultra. And it means something like, nothing further beyond. Nothing more beyond. These were warnings for sailors and for navigators to go no further because who knows what lies, if you go through those two mountains out into the Atlantic, nobody knows what's going to happen to you. You'll never be heard from again. So, nothing further beyond. Except, we know there was. In 1518, a man named Ferdinand Magellan, you've perhaps heard of him, decided he wanted to prove those warning wrongs. Now, Columbus, what did he sail the ocean blue in 1492, you remember? And so he discovered America already, so we knew there was something out there, but Magellan wanted to go even further. And so with the help of the King Charles V of Spain, the Holy Roman Emperor, he put together a fleet to go explore. And so King Charles had taken the motto, plus ultra, more beyond. He believed there was more out there. He just had to find the right person to go explore. And so he found Magellan, and he gave him the money he needed. He gave him the ships he needed, and he convinced him to look at those pillars, those two mountains, those barriers as a gateway to an unexplored and brand new world. And so with that fleet, Magellan, as you know, was the first man to sail around the world to circumnavigate the planet. Pretty amazing story. As 2014 is coming to an end and 2015 is just on the doorstep, I was praying and I was asking the Lord about the coming year, and the Lord gave me a picture of each one of us sailing the ship of our life, so to speak, through the Straits of Gibraltar. And on either side of us are warnings reminding us, non plus ultra, there's nothing more beyond. This is as far as you go. This is as good as it gets. There's no need to push the boundaries. There's no need to stretch. Just enjoy the ride right where you are. But we know better now. We know the world's round. We know lots of things we didn't know back then. And God, in the same way, is saying to each one of us this morning, and he's saying to our church, there is more beyond. Through me, your life can be better. Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be speaking to you prophetically, I hope, from the Lord about expanding your horizons in 2015, your spiritual growth, your relationships, your family, your health, your finances even. And those old barriers, those limitations where we used to stop, where it said before, there's nothing further beyond, those are going to be gateways for us as we go through them and we explore a wonderful 2015 that God's given us and the things that He wants to do in our lives. So as I'm thinking about that, as the Lord's given me this picture, I start asking the question, well, how in the world do you get to that place in life where you're going past boundaries, where you're taking risks like that? You can ask my wife. I'll tell you, I love history. I've always got a history book going. And so just history has always fascinated me, but it's my very best trivia crack category. If you're not playing that, you don't know what I'm talking about. But what fascinates me most about history is not always the events that took place, but the people behind them. And so when I think of these explorers, I think of Columbus. I try to imagine what it must have been like for Columbus to be the very first man in the world to see the Strait of Gibraltar disappear in his rearview mirror. The first guy to go past it. Everybody else stopped and turned around, or they took a right turn and stayed close to the shoreline, but he kept going straight. I wonder what it must have been like for Magellan to be audacious enough to sail to the edge of the planet and keep going. And what people must have been thinking when he came up behind them later. Get it? Because it's a circle. He went around the circle. Come on, people, you're going to have to work with me. They're not going to get better, so you might as well just give in. So what makes a person take that type of risk? And so the answer, I think, is the idea of discontentment. Discontentment simply means that you're dissatisfied with your circumstances. And so with those explorers, for instance, they were dissatisfied with the boundaries that others have said that were the limits. We don't go any further than this. This is as far as you go. This is it. They had an innate, deep-seated feeling that there was something else out there. But everybody else said, don't do it. And they were dissatisfied with that, and so they sailed through, and they went, and they took those risks. And as I was thinking about that, I realized that every one of us in life, we have boundaries. We have boundaries on us. Some of them are self-imposed. Those are some of the worst boundaries. There's the ones that we've created for ourselves. Well, I'm not smart enough. Well, I didn't get enough schooling. I'm not a go-getter. I'm paying for past mistakes. We talked about that poor theology a couple weeks ago. Well, God's mad at me for what I did years ago, and now I'm stuck here, and I can't do anything about it. I'm stuck in this job. I'm stuck in this situation, and there's nothing I can do. Then there are other boundaries that other people have imposed upon us. Those are like those signs as we're going past the Strait of Magellan that says non plus ultra, nothing more beyond. And others have told us, listen, this is as far as you're going to get. Sometimes it was our parents that put boundaries on us, or our teachers, or others we've had relationships with. Even our pastors put boundaries on us and told us this is it. And I guess boundaries are okay. God talks about boundaries a lot in the scriptures. But if we're content with sailing around in the warm, comfortable Mediterranean and not venturing far from the coastline, then boundaries are fine. You don't need to push them. You can make a great life sailing around the Mediterranean. It's beautiful. They got nice weather. And so that's fine. We can live life like that. But if you ever get dissatisfied with going around in circles or seeing the same countryside and not exploring, that's when you sail through. That's when we begin to grow. And I think the Bible is filled with discontentment. It's what I call holy discontentment. To some degree, all of the heroes of the Bible were discontent with something. Abraham was discontent with the land of Ur, and so he went where God showed him. Moses, we're going to talk about him in a moment, was discontent. Paul was discontent that the gospel wasn't being shared with the Gentiles. Peter was discontent that the gospel was stuck in the city of Jerusalem and it needed to expand. There's always discontentment in the scriptures one way or another. So we're going to talk about that, but before we do, I need to clarify something, because probably some of you are thinking I've lost my theological moorings or something. The Bible is very clear that we are to be content. In fact, there's four passages in the New Testament on your bulletin. I've listed them for you. I encourage you this week to go look them up and read them. One of them is even in red, where Jesus said, learn to be content. But in each one of those passages, you'll discover as you read them, we're told to learn contentment in relationship to money and to things. In other words, a believer isn't to be driven by external wants and desires. That's not what makes us do what we do. We are to be driven by the Spirit. What should drive us is spiritual in nature. And so we should desire to be closer to God. We should desire to exhibit the character of Jesus. We should desire to see the kingdom of God expand through us. And so in that sense, we should never, ever be content with the spiritual status quo. We can always look more like Jesus. We can always sound more like Jesus. We can always say more of the things that Jesus would say. We can always have better, closer spiritual relationships with one another. We can always be closer to God. We can always see the kingdom expand more through us. Those are the types of things that should drive a Christian. And so in that sense, we should never be content. We should always believe that God has something more beyond. But we've got to get past those limitations. And so I want you to look with me in Exodus chapter 2. As I mentioned, there are 100 examples of biblical discontentment. But I wanted to share with you was probably the first of them. And that's a guy named Moses. You've heard of him before. Moses, in chapter 2, verse 10, we see that he grew up in Pharaoh's house. And he grew up with Pharaoh's daughter. And she named him Moses. Moses is a Hebrew word that means drawn out, pulled out. That's what he was done. He was pulled out of the water. He was in that basket, you remember. And he was pulled out, and he was given the name pulled out. That's a bad name. Anyway, he's given the name Moses. Verse 11, years later, after Moses had grown up, he went out to his own people and observed their forced labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his people, and looking all around and seeing no one, he struck the Egyptian dead and hid him in the sand. So you know Moses' story. The Hebrews, they're enslaved in Egypt, and they're growing so fast that the Pharaoh says, we got to do something about this population increase. And so he says, kill all the boys under the age of 2. So, of course, Moses is born. His mother's not real keen on that idea, so she hides him in a basket in the reeds on the Nile River. Pharaoh's maiden goes out to wash one day with the Pharaoh's daughter, and they find him. They pull him out, and they bring him up, and he's raised in Pharaoh's household. I love the irony of God. I like to point this out when we read the scriptures, that God's deliverer from Egypt is raised in the Pharaoh's house. That's funny. I think it's funny. So here he is. He grows up in the lap of luxury. He's got everything he wants. He's got the best education. He's got wealth. He's got power. He's got luxury. But he realizes at some point in his life, we don't know when and we don't know how, but he realizes that he's a Hebrew. He knows there's something different about him and that he's not an Egyptian. And we know he knows this because in verse 11, it reminds us, Exodus is probably written by Moses. We don't know that for sure, but if it was, then this is Moses' autobiography. And he tells us, Moses was out after he'd grown up. Moses was out and he was observing what was happening to his own people. And so he was on a stroll and he was out observing what was happening to his fellow Hebrews, his own people. Now, the Egyptians, in the meantime, were building a great empire, one of the greatest empires of the ancient world, and they were building it on the backs of slaves, on the backs of these Hebrew slaves. They had no freedom, they had no rights, they had no property. What we read in verse 11, that their labor was forced. They didn't ask politely if the Hebrews would build their pyramids. They were forced to work. And so my guess is that as Moses discovers about himself that he's Jewish, that he's a Hebrew man, and he sees this forced labor subjugating his own people, it makes him very uncomfortable. Can you imagine what was going through his mind? He doesn't know what to do with all of this. But he sees it. He sees his own people being forced into labor. He's growing up in the Pharaoh's house in the lap of luxury. He's probably conflicted. He probably feels guilty. And yet somehow he's resigned to live with it. He thinks, you know, this is the way it's always been. This is the way it always will be. There's nothing I can do about it. And so he somehow learns to live with this. And so he watches it. But something on this day changed. Verse 11, years later, he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. My guess is this wasn't the first time he'd ever seen someone, a Hebrew slave, beaten. But something about this day changed everything. I don't know if you've ever seen a fight. I remember the first fight I saw in junior high school scared me to death. I was seventh grade, first day of school. I thought, man, what have I gotten into here? I was probably about this big. I just kind of hid in the shadows for a while, because I didn't want to get beaten up. But it'll change you when you see violence, not on TV, not staged, not a movie, but when you see it. And he sees it, and something happens. It's the proverbial straw that breaks the camel's back. And Moses decides he's going to do something about it. And so, little something about me. I'm a very deep philosophical thinker. And so I like to think of things in terms that I can relate to. And so when I hear this, read this story, I think of one of my childhood heroes, Popeye the Sailor Man. Deep. Think about Popeye, because he's going to come up again. Popeye has, in each episode, Popeye has the patience of a saint. He puts up with Brutus for quite a while. Until eventually he says, I've had alls I can stands and I can't stands no more, right? He eats a can of spinach and the rest is history. And so Moses has a Popeye moment. These kids are up here Googling Popeye. What is a Popeye? And so Moses has that moment. Moses sees his fellow Hebrew getting beaten. He eats a can of spinach, and he jumps in there to save him. And things get out of control. He ends up killing the Egyptian, and then now he's in trouble, and he buries him in the sand, and he leaves. Look at verse 13. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting. And he asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you attacking your neighbor? Who made you leader and judge over us?" The man replied, "Are you planning to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" And then Moses became afraid and thought, "What I did is certainly known." And when Pharaoh heard about this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in the land of Midian. So the very next day, after Moses takes care of that one Egyptian that was beating the Hebrew, he walks out again to observe what's going on with his people. Perhaps he's going thinking, you know what? I made a real difference. I really helped my people yesterday. I stood up for my roots. For the first time, I declared who I am. And so he goes out, and he's thinking things are going to be better. And what he discovers is something much worse. He finds two Hebrews fighting each other, and he can't believe it. And he starts yelling at them, "What are you doing? We're on the same team. We're Hebrews. We've got to unite against the enemies." Kind of like my little brother and me, if we'd just united against my evil big brother, we could have done some good, but he always pitted us against each other. And so now the Hebrews are fighting each other. And Moses realizes that this culture of violence that the Hebrews have been reared in for generations now had seeped into their own culture, and the Hebrew culture itself was imploding in on itself. And Moses realizes, if the Egyptians don't kill us or work us to death, we'll kill each other. And he throws his hands up in frustration. He's had it. He says, that's enough. I'm out. And so he leaves and he runs away to the land of Midian. And so he's frustrated, he's angry, and he's discontent. And he hides in Midian, and there, while he's in Midian, he finds a wife, he finds a nice career, he has a great life, he settles down, except that God shows up in chapter 3, verse 1. Meanwhile, Moses was shepherding the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led the flock to the far side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And then the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of a fire within a bush. And as Moses looked, he saw that the bush was on fire, but it was not consumed. And so Moses thought, I must go over and look at this remarkable sight. Why isn't the bush burning up? And when the Lord saw that he had gone over to look, God called out to him from the bush, Moses, Moses. Here I am, he answered. Do not come closer, he said. Remove the sandals from your feet, for this place where you are standing is holy ground. And then he continued, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. And then the Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people in Egypt and have heard them crying out because of their oppressors, and I know about their sufferings. I have come down to rescue them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them from that land to a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. The territory of the Canaanites, Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, and Hivites, and Jebusites. The Israelites' cry for help has come to me, and I have also seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, go. I am sending you to Pharaoh so that you may lead my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. Now, all us good church-going folk know that that is the moment. The burning bush moment, that is the call of God onto Moses. You can picture it in your mind's eye. Charlton Heston standing there in front of that bush with the cellophane kind of blowing in when they didn't have good computer graphics back then. And you're like, what is that? Is that a flame? I don't know what that is. Anyway, that was the moment that changed everything for Moses when God spoke to him. But what's interesting about it is I want you to look at verse 7 again. Verse 7 says, the Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people in Egypt. I have heard them crying out because of their oppressors, and I know about their suffering. So God says, listen, I have seen it with my own eyes. I've heard it with my ears. I've heard their cries. I've heard their prayers. And I know what's going on. The Hebrew, if you translate it literally, the Hebrew says this, I have also observed the misery of my people. I have also heard their cries, and I also know their situation. So God's not informing Moses of anything that Moses already doesn't know. Moses already knows exactly what's going on back in Egypt. God's letting Moses know that he knows it too. In fact, if you look at verse 9, he says it specifically, the Israelites' cry for help has come to me, and I have also seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them. You remember, Moses saw it. He was out one day in verse 11 of chapter 2, observing their forced labor. He was out watching it. And he heard the cries, and he saw it, and he knew it. And so now Moses realizes he and God are on the same page. God, like Moses, was discontent with the Hebrews' situation. And so God calls Moses. He gets his attention in a way that would get Moses' attention, a bush that doesn't burn up. He goes over to it, and then God speaks to him, and God says, Moses, I'm sending you. I've been looking for someone exactly like you who feels the way you feel about this situation. And you've been frustrated with it. You were discontent with it. You acted out on it in your own power, and that didn't work for you. Here you are hiding in Midian because of it. But I'm going to send you now on my mission. And God says, if you'll go with me, I will take that holy discontent that you have inside of you, and I will harness it and I will use it to set our people free from slavery. Now, if you know the story, you can look at verse 11. It takes God a bit of convincing to get Moses to agree to go. But when Moses does go back to Egypt, he's nothing like that young hothead that we saw earlier that killed the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. When Moses goes back now, he shows amazing restraint. He shows amazing patience. He shows divine supernatural wisdom as he speaks to the Pharaoh and to the Pharaoh's court and the magicians. It's night and day, the difference of Moses when he tried to help out at first and when he goes back under God's power. The difference is that Moses went back because of God's calling. God spoke to him. God sent him. God empowered him. So let's take a minute and let's discuss that. And if you'll allow me to go back to my brilliant analogy before, let's compare Moses and Popeye. Moses and Popeye both tend to go along with the status quo. They put up with it. Moses puts up with the enslavement of his people. He lives under it for years. Somehow he's content to live under that for a while. Popeye puts up with Brutus all the livelong day and his propositions to olive oil, who is beautiful and worth fighting for. Both Moses, if you're Googling olive oil, they spell it weird, O-Y-L. Both Moses and Popeye, at some point, come to the end of their rope. Their patience runs out. They come to that moment where they can't stand no more. And then both of them take matters into their own hands to vanquish their enemies, be it an Egyptian or be it Brutus or Bluto. Here's the difference between the two of them. God's called one of them. God called Moses. God spoke to him. In fact, verse 8 says that God, in God's description, he says, I have come down. And so God has come down to grab the attention of Moses and to turn his direction, if you will. Moses realizes that he's run from his problems, and he's run from the problems of his fellow believers. He was able to help out in one situation. Okay, he walks up on this scene, and there's a Hebrew slave being beaten. He jumps in, he saves that guy's life. And he leaves and he thinks, you know, I've done something great. You know, I'm a deliverer of my people. He goes back home and he sleeps in the luxurious palace. He goes out the next day and he sees that nothing has changed. Is that frustrating to you? When you think you made a difference, you go back the next day and you realize nothing's changed, everything's the same. And he realizes he may have helped out in that one situation, but there were millions, literally millions of people that were suffering the same beatings that he'd seen previously. And so Moses hides in the desert. Now, that doesn't solve anybody's problem, but it helps Moses forget about it. And so he's concentrated on, he's got a job, he's got a 9-to-5, he's got to work, he's got a family to support, he's got the plumbing needs to be repaired, the car's broken. He's got all kinds of things to take his attention away from what he knows is really eating at him. So God gets his attention at the burning bush and God says, listen, we're going back. This is a chance for you to take that discontentment you felt and you still feel that you've just kind of stuffed away, but this is a chance for you to take that and do something about it, to really make a difference. I know, Moses, you want to make a difference, but you don't think you can. I'm going to show you how. Now, in order for that to work, he would have to go back in the power of God because there was no way for the Hebrews to come out of this situation. This is the most powerful nation in the world, the most powerful army in the world. The Hebrews have absolutely, they're literally powerless to change their situation. There's no chance for an armed revolt, an armed uprising, nothing. In fact, verse 8, God even admits the power of the Egyptians. He says, I've come down to rescue them from the power of the Egyptians. The only thing that will save them is God. Well, God knows that. Now Moses is beginning to understand it. And so Moses goes back to Egypt, and he goes in the power of God. So, bring this all together. Every year, we Americans, we have a tradition. We make New Year's resolutions that we don't keep. That's kind of our New Year's tradition. We eat black-eyed peas on New Year's Day, and we make resolutions that we break. And here's the reason why I think we break our New Year's resolutions. Number one, the resolutions we make don't come from holy discontentment. They come simply from discontentment. I'm frustrated with this about my life. I don't like this about my life. I don't like this about my situation or whatever. And so we're discontent, and so we say, I'm going to change that. Here's what I'm going to do. So it comes from discontent, but not necessarily holy discontentment. Number two, we usually try to accomplish our New Year's resolutions by spinach power alone, by our own willpower, by our own thinking, by our own strength. We're just going to buckle down. We're just going to do it. The difference with Moses is that God says, listen, you are discontent, but so am I. So we're going to go together into this. And I'm going to send you, not on your own strength, because your own strength didn't work. You killed one guy, and then you ran away. I'm going to send you back in my power. And when you go back in my power, you can make a big difference. That's the difference. That's what happened with Moses. And so this morning, I guess what I'm telling you is that it is okay to be discontent. In fact, I would suggest that it's a good thing to be wholly discontent. That means you've got spiritual life in your spiritual bones. Just like you're breathing. Today shows that you're living, you're having life in your bones today. Spiritual discontentment shows the same thing. I'm discontent. Now, it's kind of new for me. There was a time when, just be real honest with you, I was an explorer. I loved to see the Straits of Magellan in my rearview mirror and go into new areas or whatever, but over the years, I've gotten used to the nice, warm, safe waters of the Mediterranean. It's like being in a bath. It's nice and comfortable. I'm happy with the sunshine and the lack of storms and waves. And subconsciously, I've taken the motto, non plus ultra, nothing more beyond. It's pretty nice. But 2014's now gone, and God is saying to me, and I think to us, that there is more in Him. There's more for our church. We need to be discontent where we are. We need to be discontent that more people are not coming to saving faith in Jesus Christ because of our efforts. How many people have we led to the Lord this year? And I'm talking to myself too. Now, I've led a lot more people to the Lord than you have because they come into my office, and that's my job. But that should make us discontent. Discontent in my marriage. I'm actually very happy in my marriage, but I know it can be better. And so there's some things that we can do in our marriage, in our health and well-being with my kids, with my finances, relationships. So it's okay to be discontent. In fact, it's a good thing to be discontent if it's a holy discontent. And so that's God's word for us in 2015, more beyond. Sounds kind of weird, but that's the motto, plus ultra. I thought about doing it in Latin, but that's even weirder, all right? So more beyond is what the Lord is speaking to us. If you want more beyond, then as the Lord is saying there is for you, then you've got to, first of all, ignore those warning signs. Even the well-meaning ones that people have put up for you. No, this is nothing further beyond. Don't go any further. It's dangerous out there. Just stay put. Stay nice and calm. Stay here. Don't move forward. You've got to see those things that were once your barriers, once your limitations. Those are gateways to what God has for us in the future. And you say, well, I don't function in that gifting. That's my limitation. Not this year. The Lord says there's more beyond. Amen. Well, I'm uncomfortable sharing my faith. Not anymore. Amen. This year there's more beyond. And the Lord's going to lead you through it. But that leads us to the most important thing. You've first of all got to be ready. You've got to be uncomfortable with the boundaries. Like I said, if you're not uncomfortable with the boundaries, you're fine. You can stay exactly where you are. But my guess is most of us are uncomfortable with something in our life. We're dissatisfied with something in our life that we believe God has more for us. Once we get uncomfortable enough that we can admit it and we can see those boundaries for what they are as gateways into a scary, dangerous world out there, that's step one. But the most important step is that you got to hear from God in it. Otherwise, it's just another new year. It's just another resolution. And so God's got to speak to you. If you've been discontent but nothing has changed, you've got to let God, as he did with Moses, take that discontentment and let him harness it and let him do something about it. That was the difference with Moses. Moses was discontent before. When he went back, God took that discontentment and used it with his power. So don't try to fix it on your own. Don't try to fix it with thinking through it and with your own willpower, your own brain power, your own strength. Take it to the Lord and hear from him. You need to have that burning bush moment where God speaks to you. And he says, I also have seen, I also have heard, and I also know what you're feeling, because chances are God will say, I feel the same way. Son, I'm also discontent with our relationship. I know we can be closer. I know there's things that I want to speak to you, things I want to say to you, if you'll listen. I'm also discontent with your marriage. I know you're frustrated. So am I. It could be so much better. I'm also discontent with your health. I've got things I want to do in your life. I'm also discontent with your relationships. I want to heal you in this situation. So chances are, if you go to God at that burning bush and you talk to him about those things that make you discontent, you will hear him say something similar. I'm discontent too. Now that we're both in agreement, let's do something about it. So that's what I've been praying. As I've been preparing for today, I've been praying about it and I've been praying for you. And I know this sounds weird and very unpastoral, but I've been praying that God would make you discontent. Spiritually discontent, wholly discontent. I've been praying that God would show you at least one thing in your life that he wants changed. Something that you and he can agree on and work together in his spirit and his power to see that change happen. Over the next couple of weeks, we'll be talking about some of those areas. And I believe the Lord will speak to you in those. And if you know people that are struggling in these areas, bring them. So, and we'll be posting those and talking about those as they come.